This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 36th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is why gender equity is a men's issue. I'm joined by David G. Smith and W. Brad Johnson. They are the co-authors of Good Guys, How Men Can Be Better Allies for Women in the Workplace. The publisher is Harvard Business Review Press. Dave is an associate professor of sociology in the College of Leadership and Ethics at the U.S. Naval War College. Brad is a professor of psychology in the Department of Leadership, Ethics, and Law at the U.S. Naval Academy and a faculty associate in the Graduate School of Education at Johns Hopkins University. They are also the co-authors of a previous book together, Athena Rising, How and Why Men Should Mentor Women. Welcome to the show, Dave and Brad.
Glad to be here.
Great. I am looking forward to it. So let's help out the listener. Just give them a quick nutshell version of what this book is about.
Yeah. You want me to jump in, Dave? I'll go ahead and begin. So this is Brad, and I'll just kind of give you a sense about Dave and I and our journey to writing this book. We have been working together for about 9 years now, starting with our first book, Athena Rising. Dave's a sociologist. I'm a clinical psychologist. And we have noticed in our different research areas that the landscape is not equal when it comes to gender. In my area around mentoring and sponsoring, we find that women get less mentoring and sponsoring than men do. The quality is not quite as good, and men often don't engage with women in the workplace, and we have always been curious about that. Dave had been researching gender, work, and family, and so we began having these conversations about why men are often missing in the equation when it comes to really promoting gender equity and inclusion at work. So we set out to do the research. With our new book, Good Guys, we decided we really wanted to know what it looked like when men showed up as allies. So we gathered all the data we could find on great cross-gender allyship, and then we went out and did interviews, large qualitative interviews with women, and asked them, what does it look like when men really show up as colleagues, as allies, as accomplices, in promoting equity and promoting fairness in the workplace. In many cases, those women nominated a male that they thought really got it and really showed up in his behavior as an ally. And so we got interviews with those men if they were nominated by women. And so basically, we've put all of that together, Dan, as sort of the toolbox for men on how to really show up at work. And there are sort of two broad categories that Dave and I discerned. You know, there are the interpersonal, relational ally behaviors and actions, and then there are the more public systemic ally actions. So when men really put some skin in the game and do the public disruption, another really important area. So that, in a nutshell, is Good Guys.
Okay. And Dave, what would you like to add to that, perhaps?
Hey, I'm glad to be here with you and joining now. I can hear you.
Okay.
Not really sure what Brad said.
Then maybe we'll move on to the next question.
Yeah, I said that I was the brains behind our book, Dave.
True statement there.
So let's make the case for why this book is important. And I certainly agree that it is. I was so delighted to see that this book had been written and so well by the two of you. There's a lot of good statistics in this book, startling statistics, to make the case why this is important subject matter. I'll just mention one of them. The old traditional model of the male as the sole breadwinner and the stay-at-home mom is now, you report, less than 30% of all households with children in America. What are some other statistics? I mean, I just picked one there, but things that really make the case why this is so urgent and important for some progress here.
Yeah, so there's so much out there. And I think certainly one of the cases that we like to focus on is around leadership and business in particular, that, you know, organizations and leadership that are taking this seriously understand what the research and the evidence shows, that the businesses that have more gender diversity, not just at the bottom of their organization, but all the way across through the senior levels, into the C-suite, into the boardroom, right, that women are represented across the board, are much more just broadly successful. Because why? They make better decisions. They're more creative. They're more innovative. They make more money. Their profits and losses today is certainly we've shown that there is actually a direct connection between gender diversity and there are, again, other aspects of diversity that are important here too, but gender diversity at the senior levels makes a difference in terms of the profitability of an organization, the success and the ability to accomplish the mission out there. So certainly we find that that it makes it a better place to work. People appreciate leaders, right? That, again, in terms of being allies, are more clear in what they're, why this is important, and connecting it to themselves personally, as well as to the business out there.
Okay. Anything you wanted to add there, Brad?
Well, yeah. And I just want to echo what Dave said, that, you know, the research is really interesting. When one great study, Boston Consulting Group, went out to lots and lots of companies, asked hundreds of women, is your company making real progress on gender diversity and inclusion? And the number one powerful correlate of whether women said yes to that was whether or not they said they saw men in their company as championing inclusion and diversity. When the answer to that was yes, I see guys involved in this, 96% of women said, yep, I'm seeing real progress. So I think that is just one study that is illustrative of the point we're making, that men are often missing, and they're a key missing ingredient.
Sure. And the other piece of that was, in fact, you report that only 30% of the cases is there progress when men are not involved. So we're talking, what, 60% and more of a difference.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's huge. And that alone would justify this book, but there's so much more, of course. I'm curious about the 59 women. I mean, obviously, the names are sprinkled through in the comments. A little bit about how you selected them and if it ever occurred to you to perhaps include their bios in the back.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely. So part of our methodology was to try to include as many different professions and industries and occupations as possible as we were going through this, because we wanted, again, to show and to be able to see direct applicability across a variety of different settings out there. So the context of the different professions and industries was really important to us. The other one was a more of a diversity of perspectives to show, again, that the women, like men, are not a monolith, right? That they have a variety of different experiences, and that just because, you know, one woman had this experience didn't mean that all the rest of them had the same exact experiences. And so there were nuances, there were differences, and to find some of those, again, looking for, again, a diversity of perspectives, and in particular, you know, looking at perspectives around women, for women of color. Wanted to make sure that, again, we know in the research that women of color report that a lot of differences in terms of how they experience the workplace, how they're received in the workplace. And so wanted to make sure that that was incorporated. Same thing with around sexuality and age and race, I mean, class and education. All of these factors play an important part, because, again, I think what we found at the end of the day was that allyship While we were looking at it through a gendered lens, again, the intersectional aspects of this, the connections between race and gender or sexuality and gender are so important to really understanding the unique differences, and that if we're going to be allies for one group, we need to be allies for all groups, right? Because this translates broadly out there.
Yeah, and I don't think we really got very far in terms of thinking about listing all of the women that we interviewed and their bios. I think that was actually a publisher decision. So I don't think we would have minded that at all because we're so impressed with the women that we got to have these conversations with. But I think the publisher said, yeah, don't have room for that.
Well, they were very distinguished women, and there was a real variety. And I guess I was trying to like pull together the puzzle pieces of what all they represented, and maybe that would have been helpful. But I don't think it's a huge point. Certainly, in the end, one of them is Gretchen Carlson, who I knew just a bit because I was on Fox and Friends a few times. She mentions, among her other comments, she says harassment is a man's issue. One of you might unpack that for listeners.
Yeah, well, and I think it's such a good comment from Gretchen because the evidence really supports that, Dan, that, you know, this is, we're post-Me Too now, just a few years, and, you know, there were a lot of false narratives about Me Too that, you know, women caused Me Too or women are now dangerous to interact with. Clearly, Me Too was caused by some male perpetrators and serial predators in the workplace, like some that Gretchen encountered. And we've got to be very clear about that. We got to be clear that Me Too is about women asking to come to work and not be assaulted or harassed. It's really simple. It's a low bar for men. But let's not pretend that Me Too was caused by anything but male harassers. So I think that point is quite important, and the really nice illustrative story Gretchen offered us related to that was a male colleague, a male ally, and his willingness to notice when something had happened to her. This happened fairly early in her career. She had been harassed out on a shoot of some news story. The guy, the cameraman, had harassed her in a very clearly inappropriate way. She was rattled. She was upset. Went back at the newsroom. A male colleague noticed this, and he kept persistently asking, "Gretchen, what's going on? Can you share this with me? What has happened?" And finally, she let him know that, and he immediately collaborated with her in addressing the problem immediately. Believed her immediately. It was just a nice illustration of a guy actually putting skin in the game and being willing to do the public allyship.
Yeah, no, I think it was a nice story. It was a nice affirmative story. The story brings up the question of how to confront or deal with or mentor not just women, but to deal with male colleagues who sometimes are not, may not be harassment, maybe something more subtle. What's your, from your research, from your instincts, the conversations, what have you learned as, you know, in terms of like public versus private? What approaches work best? Any advice, insights you can offer us there?
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the research helps us too. The evidence that shows that one, that I think as men begin to understand that we have this assumed or high level of acceptance, right? That we assume that other men have a high level of acceptance of these biases, of these sexist comments and things that, so for example, when we're in a room where it's just men, which still happens a lot today, and a man makes one of those sexist jokes or comments, and we immediately all start looking around the room at each other and to see how everybody's going to respond. But there's this immediate assumption that, well, everybody else in the room, it has a really high level of acceptance and is okay with that, is okay with those kinds of comments or jokes being made. The reality is that in the research shows that that's not the case, that most men do not have that high level of acceptance. Most men do not. And that all it takes is that one person, and this comes from a lot of the bystander and intervention work that's been done. It just takes that one person to say something, to disrupt the status quo of what we think we know or what we think we understand out there. And so it's critical, I think, to employ that as we think about it, all the different settings we can do that, of how do we say something? And we see something and we recognize that it's out there. What are we going to see? What are we going to say? What are we going to do at that moment? But the fact is that as allies, we first and foremost recognize that we have to do something. And publicly, if you're going to do it in public instead of private, there's a lot of, obviously a lot of considerations to take into account, right? It might be in the situation of who else is in the room, who else stands to gain, right? In other words, there are benefits to saying something in front of other people out there. In particular, when women hear men stand up for these things and confront other men about this, then it validates their experiences. It validates what they were thinking. It's like suddenly it wasn't, oh, it's not just me, right? It's this guy also, he saw it, he heard it. So it validates that. It builds that self-esteem, self-confidence, and the self-efficacy to do something about it. Next time, they're more, what we find in the research, they're more likely to actually take action next time. So there are reasons to publicly do these things. The question is, you know, is this something where we want to have, what kind of relationship do we have with the person? Are they our boss? Are they a peer? Are they a junior? How old are they? Because generations sometimes might make a difference in terms of beliefs and attitudes and ideas about this. Is it just that clueless guy that, hey, he just doesn't have it, he just doesn't get it and understand? Or is it somebody, he probably gets it. It might be a blind spot for him. He's just not seeing it at the moment. And so understanding that reading that moment, right, that situation is critically important to deciding what's the best benefit. Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to accomplish is changing behavior, changing, making people aware, and then changing. It's like, well, maybe he just didn't realize it. So, and in other cases, it might be that guy that, well, I have a relationship with him, so I'm going to do it in private because I know he'll be more likely to receive it and perceive it as being something that, hey, this is somebody who cares about me and they're providing this gift of feedback, and that, oh, I need to listen to this. Like he has my best interests in mind here. So I think being very thoughtful about this, and in particular for men confronting other men, that remembering that we have to do something, and don't worry about, you know, breaking the bro code or losing your man card in the moment out there.
Okay. And what do women most look for in a male ally? What are the do's and what are there probably some don'ts as well? Either one of you want to take that on?
Yeah, well, I can begin. Let's start with a couple of don'ts. Number one, don't call yourself an ally. Dave and I are big on men showing up and doing the work and making it legitimate. You have to be consistent. You've got to pass the friend test. And what I mean by that is you need to develop trust with women, right? So it is, I can't imagine anything that would sabotage your effort to be an ally more than, you know, on one hand, showing that you're interested and that you care about equity in your verbal behavior, but then women see you in other contexts or maybe meetings or places where there aren't women around, and they hear about what you're doing, and it's not okay, right? You're laughing at sexist jokes. You're making them yourself. You're belittling women who aren't in the room. Nothing is going to undermine you more quickly than that. So don't do that. If I can give you a to-do, it would be listen. How about listen generously and spaciously? How about not making assumptions about her because she's a woman? How about, really doing the work of discerning where she'd like to go in her career in a perfect world? And then, you know, asking how you could collaborate with her to help her get there, open the right doors, make the right introductions, network her, push her forward for stretch assignments. These are some of those really important interpersonal aspects of allyship.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the word trust. It seemed to me in the end that was the most important emotion of the core emotions we might talk about, because it has so much to do with value and respect and avoiding the opposite, which is contempt and condescension. I really like that answer. Dave, anything more you wanted to add on that front?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that trust component is so critical, and part of it that I think is important for listeners to really kind of think about is the fact that, you know, allyship in our research, we found that most men, and hopefully this doesn't surprise people, but most men believe in gender equity and gender equality. And for all the right reasons that they believe in it, right? That it's important, it's the right thing to do, and for the people that they know and care about. But the challenge is that, so that just because you believe it doesn't mean you're actually doing it, right? Doing the work to create allies, to create equity in the workplace. And we get this gap in terms of how much this kind of an aspiration execution gap of what we think we're doing versus what we're really doing. And the research bears that out, that often men think just because I believe it, that I'm actually doing it. And what we need to close that gap is one, awareness, and two, feedback. And so back to the trust piece in particular, that if you don't have female colleagues or even male colleagues, right, that would consider themselves to be allies or confidants or good enough friends and peers and colleagues to be able to give you that really direct, unvarnished feedback, we're never going to close the gap, because you're never really going to understand how much you're really doing out there. And so we really encourage men as allies to develop these close relationships with women and men, right, where they can get that gift of feedback back to and really appreciate it and be ready in the moment and practice this ahead of time, that, hey, you're going to get feedback when you're least ready for it. And that's the moment when you don't want to respond in a way that sounds defensive or threatened or in some way, that you're going to say something that, again, is not going to encourage more feedback. You're going to get less of it. So you need to think about, all right, what am I going to say right now? It's like, wow, thank you. It's something I'm trying to work on. Would you mind if I come back and ask you, and we have a conversation more about that later? Because I really do appreciate the fact that you've given me this gift. But something that shows that you value it and you care it and you're going to get more of it develops trust. And now, once we've got that trust dialogue going, now we can really begin to close the gap.
Sure, and to me, the trust is also important, you know, between the male ally and the woman, but also the woman to be able to trust her own instincts. You mentioned the word gaslighting in the book, and in fact, you guys have a lot of wonderful terms that you've created or put front and center in this book. I'm wondering if each of you might take a term or two and just introduce them to readers and explain what they're about and what they're significance.
Yeah, well, I'll go ahead and begin with the one that you mentioned, because I think it's an important one, Dan, the whole idea of gaslighting. You know, this is not a new idea, but I think we often don't catch it. We don't see it, especially, you know, those of us that are men. This happens to women often daily, you know, so, and both men and women can gaslight women, but I think this is something that men do without any awareness. So, you know, a woman makes a statement about something that's happened to her or something that was done to her. Maybe it was a harassing gesture or a really biased or sexist comment. She shares it with him. And he immediately begins, whether he's deliberate or not, but he's undermining her perception, right? Oh, he didn't really mean it. Or, oh, you're blowing it out of proportion. Or, you need to not be so sensitive. These gaslighting comments are designed to have her question her own experience, question her own reality, in some cases, question her own sanity about how she's perceiving the world. And this has happened to women too much, and men need to become aware of this. And, you know, first response to this in instead of the gaslighting is, I believe you, and tell me more about this. And then, how can I collaborate with you? What would feel most supportive to make sure this doesn't happen anymore? I don't want to go charging off and do all the white knighting rescuing, because that may undermine your autonomy. But I'm here as a collaborator, and I'm really willing to, you know, to think with you about how to prevent this. One more term, and I know Dave has a bunch, is the whole manterruption issue. You know, we know women get interrupted on average about 3 times more than men in the workplace, in meetings, in conversations. So, and men are usually the offenders. We're typically talking over women. So I've got to be aware of the manterrupting. I've got to be aware of when I'm doing it, and I got to be aware of how I can bring it to the attention of other men who are doing this.
I think the important thing here, Dan, and for our audience out there, is to remember that, you know, some of these have kind of interesting names, or at least they're
sure. Might be. No, I think they're very clever, but they also pack a punch. They got meaning to them.
Exactly. And that is, I think that's the key point here that we should take away. You're right on the money, is that it provides meaning to, you know, gaslighting. Without the term gaslighting there, it sounds like a bunch of, again, it could be very harmless in some ways, comments or feedback, but it's not. It has a particular meaning, and it has a particular effect. And the minute we begin to name something, right, then we can ascribe the meaning that goes with it. And so something like a man interruption is not just an interruption. It's more than that. It's the fact that again, men feel privileged in a way that they can interrupt women at any time they want, and they will. And as we begin to understand what these behaviors look like, it's really helpful then to disrupt the status quo. And at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do, is bring attention, develop awareness that these things are happening, what they are, what they mean, what their effects are. And now what do I do about it? Right. And so bro-appropriation was one of our favorites. And this also has the corollaries of heap-eating and him-itating. There are lots of kind of interesting names that go with a concept of it's so prevalent that women have given it multiple names. And this is the idea that women's ideas are not valued in the same way that men's are. Their contributions are not valued in the same way that men's are. Brad and I heard this over and over again from women in all of our interviews for both books we've written. And I remember I can still remember the first time I heard this story years ago from a woman. And she's very senior. And I just was shaking my head going, I can't believe I'm hearing this. How can this be? I've never experienced this ever in my life. And I remember, you know, afterwards, after hearing it two or three times, asking Brad, I was like, hey, this keeps coming up in the interviews. Have you ever had this happen to you? And he's like, no. And I said, me either. And so, but it was really telling to us, because here again is something that is so prevalent. Yet here are two guys who are, you know, again, trying to understand, trying to do good, and trying to push the message out there for guys to be more engaged in doing this work. Yet, if we weren't aware of it, how do we do that? How do we fix it? Because it's really hard to fix something that you can't see. And to name it and to give it meaning, and now I know what it is. Now I can talk to other men about it, and I can explain the importance of us doing something and disrupting what's going on in the status quo.
Sure. And I mean, there's, you know, really central terms of the book is gender intelligence, GQ, also situational awareness. I've always been fond of opening stanza of a poem by Wallace Stevens that goes, a duchess is not a duchess 100 yards from the carriage. Women understand this, which is suggests that guys sometimes don't. One of my favorite chapters in this book was on meetings. And, you know, we spend a lot of time in the business world in meetings. And they do have, as your book chapter pointed out, there are these pernicious patterns that exist. Maybe take us through a couple of them and some solutions to those patterns.
Yeah, certainly. I think we've covered a few of them already. You know, the
interruptions.
Fact that, the interruptions and then the appropriations and all of that. But it's more than that. Again, it's from a situational awareness perspective, and this. It's just as valid today in the virtual work from home environment as it was, you know, in the being in the physical workplace. And it's just when you walk into a space, or if you enter a Zoom room or whatever the case might be, is begin to look around and see, okay, first, who's here? And who's not here? Who's been excluded, whether intentional or not, right? And who should be in the room in this, and being aware of the content of the meeting, of the decisions, the important decisions that might be made in that meeting, the resources that are being divvied up amongst people, and the opportunities that are being given out in that meeting, and really beginning to understand and see that. And in the physical space, it was really clear because, wow, you know, sometimes it was just who had a seat at the table. Where did they have a seat at the table? Did they have a nameplate at the table? They have their title representing them at the table. Were they in the first row, second row, back even in the room? Who is being handed out all the office housework, right? This is the who's taking.
I love that term. Yeah.
Right. Another one of the terms of who's taking notes, who's being asked to go fix coffee or go bring the food for the meeting? Who's being asked to plan social events? Who's being asked to do this committee work? While important, we all know probably doesn't have the same value when it comes to promotions and advancements, right? It's work that has to be done, but nobody, you don't see any of the guys raising their hand to do it. And women often will be the first ones, because they're very uncomfortable in that setting, they're like, okay, I'll do it. And just beginning to recognize all these things. And how one of my favorites was a lot of very senior men talked to us about how they recognize from a privilege perspective how the spotlight would naturally come to them when they entered into a room. And you just see this, that everybody looks to them. And when there's a question or there's a decision to be made, they just look to them and go, I wonder what he thinks or what Evan thinks here. And these men, they said, you know, it was really important for them to begin to understand that there were a lot of situations where it wasn't so important what they thought. It was more important that they look at one of their other colleagues in the room. And often that might have been a woman, because she was the expert. She was the one leading the team. She was the one who should have been leading the discussion on this conversation. And they would just say, you know, hey, I'd love to tell you more about that. But, you know, Sheila here is the expert, and I'd really like to hear what she has to say. And so they talked about it in terms of decentering. Right, of taking the center, the spotlight away from them, recognizing it, that it was there, and then shifting it, do the lateral pass, do the toss the mic, however you want to think about the metaphor, right, of moving that back over to somebody else where it belongs.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot, including the solution to the problem there. Before we run out of time, maybe one last question, and maybe I'll put this one to Brad. Part three of the book talks about organizational change. I want to make sure we don't miss out on that element. Anything you want to, you know, offer readers, kind of take us home on?
Yeah. So I think that the key here, and there's so much in that chapter on organizational sort of allyship and systemic allyship. The systemic piece is so important. And, you know, Dave and I are noticing, and we certainly found this in our research, that companies that are really getting it around systemic allyship and men who are getting it are being quite transparent and clear about why gender inclusion, gender equity matter, why this is not just something nested in human resources, why this is crucial to the business of the company or the organization's bottom line, whatever that looks like. Then once I articulate why this matters, why it is so important, then I'm going to hold people accountable, right? And so we're seeing a best practice is to actually talk about why it matters and then make it a bottom line issue when it comes to employee evaluations, when it comes to how we assess performance of managers. Companies and individual leaders that are really getting it in the systemic area are holding folks accountable. And so I think that is just crucial.
Yeah, I wanted to end on that big picture note. So I want to thank you both so much for having been on the show today. This is Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. This has been episode number 36, Why Gender Equity is a Men's Issue. My guests, Dave Smith and Brad Johnson, they are the co-authors of Good Guys, How Men Can Be Better Allies for Women in the Workplace. You can find more information about this episode by going to my latest blog posting at https://emotionswizard.com. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. To check out other episodes, you can go to my company's website at the obligatory 3 W's and sensorylogic.com. Finally, I like to conclude every episode with an appropriate epigram. In light of today's topic, here's a quote from Jeremiah Say. He wrote, "Men of quality respect women's equality." Until next time, be kind and stay safe.